Hello out there in Radio Land. Welcome to another edition of Trash Future Adult Contemporary, playing the hits of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and today, including Steely Dan and Acoustic Alchemy. I'm Riley, and as you can hear, there is no Milo to screw with my wonderful radio opening.
Yeah, I was thinking about doing it, but I just decided I'm too old for it. I don't have the energy for it. I've had a long day.
Doing shock joke stuff. It's the free one with the gunch. And you get a bunch of like toilet flush sounds in the background. You know?
Yeah, it's good. We're just going to be doing dueling styles of radio. I'm Late Night Jazz Lonely Hearts. Hi out there, San Francisco. Who's crying because your lover has left you? Call me and I'll play your favorite song. Maybe we can talk about it.
And the gunch.
Who knows, maybe you'll win a date with the gunch.
It's TF. I'm done with the radio voice. It is.
You have a surprisingly good radio voice. You discovered that in the course of like winding up for this episode. And it's just been like, we're just radio pilled now. We're just doing
Yeah, all of us have been talking to one another in different radio voices this entire time and seriously perturbing our guest. It's Paris Marx returning. Paris, how's it going?
Ah, thanks for having me back. Yeah, great to chat with you guys again.
Say it in radio.
I'm not the radio pro like all of you. So I can't do that. I'm sorry.
You got to shift to like sort of news radio and be like, that's right, Riley.
However, reports
when you say
that
news
I am,
radio, all I think is that like, do 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 do, like, you know, that, I don't know. Is that a thing?
When we say news radio, what we actually mean is Phil Hartman. Very excited to be back for another bonus episode. It is going to be a lot of fun. We have some stuff to talk about, including a startup, which I found and have been. It was a startup. Mm. This is going to be a little hint for you. That I would have felt we couldn't talk about with Joe because it was a little bit too risky to have a Bloomberg person talking about a fintech because you don't want them to have to be too balanced about it, you know? So that's the hint. But Paris, you and I have been sort of chatting about this a little bit. I mean, to be honest, I'll part the kimono here a little bit for you folks. Half the ideas for episodes come from me talking to people that I know and thinking, hey, this is a good episode. And we are going to be doing, I think, like how last year, like every third episode we did was about crypto because that's the thing that everyone had decided the future was.
That was the space. Yeah. That's the thing that, you know, the charlatans were moving into. And now, of course, it's AI. Everything is going to be done with AI.
I'm still a believer. I'm still part of all the crypto Twitter groups that we join. Remember when the whole Twitter community thing? It is really interesting to sort of go into that and see like some true believers who are very much just like, no, we just got actually, this is the best time to get into crypto because it's the true believers that are gonna succeed.
Those guys are like the sort of like Japanese holdouts of crypto. meanwhile, we've moved on to the sort of, I guess, Korean War in this analogy of AI.
I saw an interview last week with someone who was like, Web3 isn't dead. It's still happening. I was like, no, it's not.
Web3 isn't dead, but it is being treated by the gang of Joker doctors in this Korean surgical hospital. That's us in this situation. No, we're very excited to talk about that. Basically, the AI arms race, which is heating up in between companies and countries, and the consequences that it's going to have for us. Which is
it's very funny that like in the midst of this, Britain is still in crypto. Like we're doing the fucking Edinburgh Accords or whatever.
Even our crypto politicians have kind of shut up about it recently. So
who was the British politician? It wasn't Matt Hancock, obviously, but there was someone else. Oh, okay. So he was one. So yeah, crypto is still a thing. I think the Treasury NFT is still happening.
Is Rishi still on the crypto train? Because he was big on that.
Still on the crypto thing. The Edinburgh reforms are to make the UK a more attractive destination for crypto. And we talked about this on a previous episode. The former chancellor is now joining a crypto exchange. So, hey, you know what? We're not the band playing while the ship sinks. At this point, we are the skeletons of the band that James Cameron's going to find later. And we are still holding out for that rescue boat to come.
Titanic Midnight Radio, taking you through the night.
Yeah, no, he's got to find the skeletons, put them in the machine, turn them all into Navi. It's Avatar free, baby.
That's going to be us. Avatar Britain. yeah, but before we get into all the stuff in the news and so on, there was a video sort of making the rounds the other day, especially like in Britain, that I thought was worth discussing. It was a bunch of, like every so often, sort of a bunch of young Tories will like forget that much of what makes their ideology coherent is that they all seem to like being off-putting. And we'll forget that there's a camera in front of them or that the camera connects to other people.
Yeah, and usually that camera is wielded by Reem Ibrahim of the like LSE fucking Hayek Society, who has sort of made a habit of putting cameras in the faces of fellow sort of like Tory undergraduates. And, you know, inevitably, right, it's the length of one TikTok, which is... you know, less than a minute, they cannot get through that without one of them doing like attack helicopters, Mussolini made the trains run on time, any of the sort of like little crypto fascist dog whistles. They can't help themselves.
And not even obvious ones. I believe the one in this one was a reference to one sort of these, again, like drunk, you know, barely children.
Yeah. We'll play it. We can have Nate at it.
Nate, can you play a few of the clips here?
I'm Michael, and I think castor oil has many uses.
Yeah, this is obscure, but not to me. And this is why you need people like me, annoying nerds on the left, is because I immediately recognize that as it's a thing that the Squadristi used to do in like fascist Italy and pre-fascist Italy, was like force feed political opponents castor oil in order to make them like shit themselves a lot. So it's just fully like this motherfucker, the weirdest looking sort of like visible KCL physiognomy motherfucker I've ever seen in my life. Habsburg ass, jaw folding in on itself, gurning motherfucker going, no, I would have been in the fucking, in the Squadristi with Mussolini, you know? I don't think so. I simply don't. I don't feel threatened by it is the thing. And like, there's a lot of fascism that's sort of obviously comical on its face. And, you know, you can sort of analyze fascism's ability to like make itself, you know, worthy of mockery and still be terrifying at the same time. This motherfucker is not feeding anyone anything.
Oh yeah,
I will be honest.
He'd get the fucking Marinetti treatment, where he'd go up to the soldiers and be like, "Oh my god, can I please try to turn myself into your gun?" And they'd be like, "Fuck off, nerd." but the thing I think that the reason this is interesting to bring up is that a lot of, not all of them, but a lot of these people, right? It's worth sort of stepping back, especially for international listeners, which is that a lot of the ways you become like a party Mandarin or end up getting selected for a safe seat or whatever, the West Streeting method, basically, of sort of political career making is through things like your university society. You know, you join that, you get involved in student politics, you make connections at the party, and then you become an insider, and then you get like a communications secretary job. Maybe you work for an MP. You do it long enough, you get parachuted into a safe seat.
Yeah, that explains the curious divide in these videos, where it's sort of like 90%, well, no, it's about sort of like 30% incoherence, like someone sort of like drunkenly slurring that they're like economically conservative but socially liberal, 30% fascist dog whistles, and then the remainder is sort of like seemingly nice kids who don't know what they've gotten into, staring terrified down this camera like, business? Small business. And it's like you can tell the ones who are there because their parents told them, you know, this is a good route to get into politics. You know, you'd be very good at that. So, you know, just, you know, climb the ladder, keep your head down. Don't say any weird things about 1920s fascist paramilitary formations. But they're all handcuffed together is the thing. They're all tied together by TikToks.
But the thing I'm sort of driving at, the reason I bring it up as well, is that this is, and the reason I bring up the sort of standard political career progression in the UK, is that if you want to look at the future of your parties, you look at what the student societies are doing. What are they like? What are the dominant political ideologies in those student societies? Because those are going to be the people who are like making and adjudicating on like rules decisions. They're going to I'm not saying all of these people are going to end up influential, but a lot of the ways that you get into working at like 55 Tufton Street, a lot of the ways in which you get to be working in the party or associated organizations is through these channels. And if what the one thing that these guys all seem to have in common, or many of them, is that they seem to be largely like hyper online groypers whose entire worldview seems to be based on being upsetting and off-putting to normos. And that's these kinds of people. The West reading of the Tory party of the Tory party in 10 years is probably like was in that other Tory like student society photo where they like painted Hitler mustaches on each other and put on shirts that said like defund the NHS.
Here's the thing though. The Conservative Party is by all accounts about to get owned. And when it does, it's like need for these guys is going to shrink commensurately. There was a time 10 years ago when you joined this kind of society in order to become a SPAD, to become, you know, eventually an MP or work at a think tank or whatever. And you could get quite a good living off of that and basically be sort of like beneath notice in a Conservative Party of like, you know, 200-300 seats or whatever. In a Conservative Party with 20 seats, and I think the current polling has them down to 10. They're not gonna need these guys. And like, okay, fine, for the groypers, I don't feel bad. Despite myself, I feel a little bit bad for the sort of like sort of deer in the headlights looking ones who are just like, oh, this seemed like a good route into politics, and who are now going to be like saddled to, you know, based Keck Hitler 1488 for the rest of their lives.
What? You wrestle with a pig, you're both gonna get muddy, except the pig's gonna enjoy it. I have no pity for these people.
Does that shake it up though and like open it up to them? Like if the Conservative Party gets like crazy defeated at the next election, does it open it up for them to like for these like more kind of extreme and like out there views to get more influence?
Oh yeah.
I have some thoughts on this only because when I was thinking about, so I went to a university where it's kind of like they did have the biggest like student conservative party association in the country. Which was very, very funny. And like I went during the sort of like coalition austerity years, and you kind of did have those sort of distinctions of Tories, like ones who were like very much just the same as everyone who was joining like political parties at university. They kind of think that it'll open up career opportunities. Some of them want to go work at the party. And then you had others that were just sort of there to kind of be provocative and who sort of were kind of, they sort of saw themselves as outliers because they associated with like the more sort of extreme libertarian elements of the Tory party at the time. I think like that is still very much the case, but obviously like your extreme end of the Tory party now is very, very different to like the most extreme end being like David Davis back in 2010.
David Davis has never shared like a helicopter death squad.
I lived with one of these Tories in my first year who was very much someone who, if he was in university now, would probably be doing like castor oil jokes or like, you know, Pol Pot bits and everything. And he, I think from what he works like at a sort of big four consultancy and doesn't really post about politics anymore. And it's not to say that he doesn't have them, but I think like you have one element of the Tory, both Tories who like, yeah, you're going to end up in management consulting and like, you're going to broadly be fine. But what I do think is that like when the Tories do get decimated, I think there will be a period of time where like they're not really sure what they're going to do or what they're supposed to do. And that's where, and you know, I've seen like some kind of very online, like right-wing people talk about this, like on Twitter and TikTok and everything, where they're like, well, actually defeat will be really good. Because then we can kind of like shape the Tory party in a cultural way that like, you know, it needs that sort of extreme element that we sort of see in the States and to a degree like in other countries as well. Whether that's a successful strategy or not, I don't think it will be over here, mm-hmm. Electorally speaking, but I wouldn't discount the fact that like at least with a four, like five, maybe kind of, you know, just under 10 years or so, that will like, you know, yeah, those types of like cultural forces will be quite prominent in political discourse generally, even if it isn't sort of strategic, like even if it isn't really effective strategically.
It's going to be very funny with like these fuckers trying to sort of like red pill the Conservative Party in its wilderness years and instantly getting crushed by the iron hammer of
Did that with like the whole like Sargon shit, right? Again, I don't want to like talk about this anymore, but yeah, like
by way of summing up, Paris, you go ahead, then I'll sum up.
No, I was just going to say, I feel like we frequently get these kind of videos out of the UK, right? With these like absolutely unhinged, like young conservatives. And I feel like, you know, I'm over here in Canada. I feel like we don't really get that same sort of thing with like young conservative. I don't see videos of them doing like, you know, fun references to fascism and stuff. Maybe they just don't use TikTok as much. I don't know. Maybe there are not so many younger conservatives here. It's a smaller country population wise, not size wise.
I have a theory for that. I have a theory for that, which is that the extremely tight interconnection between think tanks, newspapers, TV channels, parties, and all of their affiliated groups means that everyone, a lot of people, especially people who are trying to get noticed by them, tend to think in these terms all the time. And there is a lot more of a, I think, immediate and institutional reward for being off-putting to people you don't like. So I think the UK incentivizes strange and unpleasant behavior.
Yeah, it's the same way we got to like the Liz Truss minister.
You know, I think it's possible Canada moves in that direction too, though, because our conservative leader right now is just like an absolute nutcase and loves to go in on that culture war stuff.
He does the same thing. That's his strategy. Let's see if he can do Liz Truss to Canada. It's gonna be great. But I think, but just before wrapping up, because I do want to move off of this one thing, right? Which is that the last time the Tories were in the wilderness years, what they did was they did the actually quite strategic strategic shift of Cameronism, which is where, for example, which was like a sort of tactically effective idea for them at the time. It's why they have like they focused on a lot of diversity, not necessarily ideological diversity, but they hired a lot of women, they hired a lot of ethnic minorities.
they're gonna do the same thing again and be like in the wilderness with five MPs trying to recreate Keir Starmer in a sort of cloning vat.
but that's the thing, right?
Getting a Tory Keir Starmer that calls upon you to go further still, twice as far.
But the thing is, right? I think that the what's happening is that as it intensifies, it could be that like that they just do the same thing where they look at Starmerism, which was a sort of copy of what had come before it, and try to copy that. Or, you know, they could do something else entirely, which is as more of the regular people sort of abandon the Tory party, it gets taken over by like people who are much more willing to say make castor oil references in public. And that's not to say that, oh, we need a strong Tory party, because quite frankly, we don't. But that's more to say that because of the way our country's institutions are set up, having a Tory party is pretty much inevitable. And the fact that it's inevitable means that the worse it does, I actually think, the more likely it is to be a very close conduit to power for people who describe their politics approvingly as a personality disorder.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's too soon to say, and I think we'll need to see what sort of like electoral results they're working with. But yeah, I think that's a danger, certainly.
We will see. Another couple of very fast items on the news. Prince Andrew vindicated
lightning
by photo.
News. This is the weirdest thing that the British press has done in a minute, which is
yeah, exactly,
you know, closely
one
to be followed
minute,
by
you're
everything
right.
else. Yeah, we're talking about. Prince Andrew, was it the Mail?
Yeah.
Or the Express? The
Telegraph.
It was the Mail.
The Telegraph.
Fuck me, running. So the Telegraph says that Prince Andrew can't have nonced an underage, well, a child, in a bath, as alleged by her and as came out in the Ghislaine Maxwell sort of trial and process, on the basis that the bath is too small to nonce anybody in. And they have proven this with a photo of two of their journalists wearing paper printouts of Prince Andrew and Virginia Giuffre's faces over their own.
I couldn't believe this when I saw like the front
country.
Page of this newspaper. I was like, is this for real?
A national newspaper.
A national newspaper being like, no, you see, this bath is hardly large enough for nonsense. And you could tell me, and just so you know, we taped paper masks to our... Honestly, I'm trying to imagine the industry of tasks that has emerged around shielding this one man from justice. How many people take home a paycheck that is for the job of making sure that this one sweaty idiot lives a life completely free of fucking consequences?
I had more questions about the morph suits, not the morph suits, but just the weird suits that they had to wear beyond the mask, right? Because like,
That's 3D modeling,
like,
so they can put that into the metaverse.
Right, like,
you know?
Why are they wearing the long johns? I don't understand that.
Like, do they have to go, oh, well, we're going to go prove Prince Andrew's innocence with a bath. You two print off pictures of their faces. You go buy some long underwear. We're going to crack this thing.
If you wear, like, any clothes, it might look a bit weird. So, like, you know, and obviously you can't be naked because that might, that might cause some. So buy some white long johns instead and it'll be fine. I don't know what to say about this. It's very...
I love journalism.
It's just, yeah, it is just very, like...
What an amazing industry.
Yeah, I've spent so much of my life wanting to be part of it, and every day I think to myself, I could have just been doing so many other things.
Yeah, you could have been in that bath.
Like every other industry in Britain, if you want to do something, in this case journalism, your reward is to be like piled high with untold humiliation. And if you get humiliated enough, then you know, eventually maybe you might get to do like a crumb of the thing you actually wanted to do.
The queen is dead now. I think they should just like let him fall. Like, you know, she won't know.
Yeah. Just a limited hangout. It's the time. King Charles, if you're listening, just let him go. You know, you got to do him Fredo style, you know?
Andrew, you broke my heart.
We have a new black coin that came out like last week over here.
Oh, the goth coin. Yeah, goth coin. Your goth money.
Yeah, to commemorate the queen's death. And I was like, man, I got to get my hands on one of those. Black money.
Every Canadian is now Anton Chigurh a little bit. Cool.
Imagine the commemorative coins they'll have to put out when Andrew gets arrested after like Charles does him Fredo style. I guess that's not what doing someone Fredo style means. I just find it a funny phrase. But like, yeah, no, I look forward to the like Prince Andrew perp walk commemorative coin.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what it's for. Maybe that's our £1 trillion coin that we mint.
There we go.
Oh, fuck. We've solved it. We've solved the economy. £1 trillion coin. It's Andrew in like handcuffs between two detectives. Perfect.
Also, a little bit of quick news. We're not going to bother talking about the Nadim Zahawi stuff because it's like, yeah, of course all of these
guys are thieves. Yeah, and of course they're robbing the... You know, the tax man and you, fine, whatever. And
it's convenient to notice it now. It's not a conspiracy now, and now the press can notice it because the danger of something else has passed, yada, yada. So, other things. In a move that shocks nobody, The Observer has come out for women's rights by celebrating Nick Cohen's retirement and then minimizing the crimes and abuses of Andrew Tate by saying he's...
Yeah, the Nick Cohen commemorative coin.
By saying he's worse than... certain Labour MPs who oppose the Section 35 order. So all in all, Britain's press and institutions absolutely having a fantastic day.
A plus.
Yeah, it's a sort of peak Observer there is like, oh, you condemn Andrew Tate and yet you don't condemn trans women. Interesting. It's like, it's such a bullshit gotcha. It's like sort of stepping sort of very noticeably onto this rake and having it hit you in the face and be like, ah, interesting. You make fun of me for stepping on this rake.
Yourself have not stepped on the rake, I see, however.
Yeah,
I
mean, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's just kind of... I think all the takes have sort of already been made already, and like people have sort of said... But I guess in my mind, it's very much like, okay, you've got this figure that is like radicalizing, in a very literal sense, like so many young men across the country who are like... openly, you know, you talked like every teacher
She's
I've
got a lot of podcasts.
Yeah, sorry. Well, every teacher I've spoken to has kind of been like, yeah,
about J.K. Rowling.
Like, we've had to address like the Andrew Tate stuff, regardless of whoever he wants to, because basically, like, boys are sort of telling girls that like their pussies and all. I don't want to like say the more vulgar stuff, obviously. And then to sort of be like, okay, well, yeah, we have this problem that is very evident.
Boy who was kind of like misunderstood, yeah. Andrew Tate telling a girl her pussy is like disappointing.
I didn't realize how influential he was until
he's kind
he got
of, arrested. I mean, yeah. Again, the thing is, it's like, it's sort of like insane when you really think about what he says. But again, it's very much like, okay, well, yeah, actually what he's saying is dangerous, but not in the way that like certain people are kind of saying it. I don't know how to describe it necessarily, but it's very much like, okay, you see this evident problem of like young impressionable men kind of like regurgitating like the most violent parts of, you know, of like supporting patriarchy, and you're like, yeah, this is exactly the same as trans people generally, like not even a specific thing, just like generally their existence is exactly the same as Andrew Tate. Andrew Tate telling young men that they should be drinking like multiple I think the coffee.
Okay, look, Hitler said good morning, if you just keep
the gender that you were assigned at birth, that's poor guy shit.
Even Hitler said good morning.
This is expensive custom gender.
So, like, sparkling water is still good. Look, I don't want to spend too much time on the news. Those are just some things I wanted to bring up. I want to talk about Telus, TELLUS. It's a startup. It's a fintech. I didn't want to talk about it with Joe the other day. So I've
what,
saved
is it
for this
telecom company in Canada?
It is. Hello. I was going to say, no, it is not. It is a fintech company in the USA. Mm. So as our guest, Paris, you get first guess.
Oh, damn. Okay. It's a fintech company. I need to guess what it does.
Oh, yeah. Tell us.
Telus. Is it one of those like online survey companies that pays you for surveys? No, that's a bad guess.
No, not correct. Not really what a fintech would do. Alice.
Okay, what's the worst thing I can think of?
Welcome to Trashing, the podcast that is rude to its guests once it becomes friends with them.
This is, it's a way of like automating or like offshoring your compliance operations. So all of your like reporting requirements or whatever, it just does those for them and it does them very poorly.
That is such a better guess than mine.
That actually sounds like a pretty good business. TM, you can't do it.
It's almost like I've been doing this like twice a week for multiple years.
Hussein, tell us. And you know what? I'm going to give you the first line of the copy.
Okay, this might ruin what I was going to say. I mean, it's up to you. It's up to you. I had two ideas for it. Number one, an American version of William Tell? Don't really know what that's about. Number two, a fintech has invented an anime girl because they want to encourage people to tell the anime girl their crimes. And so it's a surveillance bot, but it knows its audience well.
And then can extort them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, that's number one, good idea. No.
Yeah, that's a $1 million, patent pending. The chatbot that like Mirandizes you first, every single fucking groiper on the internet would confess.
I was thinking, I was just like, fuck, this is actually a very good idea, even if it does serve like an anime girl, very bad purposes.
TM.
You don't have to talk to me. You are allowed a lawyer. If you can't afford a lawyer, one will be like assigned to you.
Yeah, we're going
to
get the do not pay.
And all these guys are like, you mean about the pipe bombs I planted? Yeah,
sure. It's an anime girl that understands you in a better way than everyone else.
Okay. All right. I'm going to give you another hint, and then I'm going to start going into it. It's Telus. You can turn your savings into passive income and earn between 3.95 and 5.5% APY. That's very high. That's very high.
Yeah.
Starting again with Paris. Say,
it can't be a crypto scam. We're already past that stage.
No, not crypto. Not crypto. It's not crypto.
Oh, fuck. Is it going to invest your shit using AI?
Not AI, but it does invest your shit. Hussein, last guess before I reveal.
Okay, it won't invest your shit, but it will invest your semen somehow. Everyone's into semen retention. It has something to do with semen retention and adding monetary value to that.
You can earn 3.95 to 5.5% APY. That's up to 22 times the average savings account. Asterisk. All while keeping your cash out of the markets. Asterisk, asterisk.
I'm sensing an architectural shape.
Is that Sam Bankman-Fried's new startup from his like house arrest or whatever he's in right now?
No, but it was invested in by Andreessen Horowitz. Here it is. When you deposit your money into your Telus savings account, we supercharge your returns with interest generated by real estate. Your earnings.
Oh no. This is the thing that you like. Invest all your money in, and then you look at the calendar and it's like January 1st, 1929. This is, don't do this. Oh, this is such a horrible idea on so many levels. The real estate in the US is like owned by, as we've talked about now, two hedge funds at this point. That's the level of consolidation it's on, and you're going to like, get a piece of that moments before the whole thing collapses due to sort of like one or other sort of like Jenga piece we pull out, and it's gonna just like eat you your savings.
Not even
money you put aside to invest, just like your own. This is terrible.
Yeah, that's pretty much the size of it, Alice. You more or less nailed it.
Oh my god. At least in the olden days when you were about to lose all of your money on land, it would be because they had defrauded you about the state of the land. They would be like, oh, you can buy a bunch of, Windward land on Florida, and it turns out that it's all swamps or whatever, and it's worthless, and now you're bankrupt. Now it's just like, oh yeah, you can buy the sort of the subdivisions, you can buy the McMansions or, some sort of like investment instrument that like controls a part of them. You're still just as fucked. It's just in a more sort of baroque way.
That's right. So your earnings are paid to you daily and your money can be pulled out at any time. And then this is where it does one of the most annoying things I've seen a startup do in a while, where it's like the small print happens frequently as you scroll through their page. with like little emojis and stuff. But it says, friendly reminder that Telus is a financial technology company and not a bank. We hate to sound like a broken record, but we are not a bank. We are a financial technology company.
Your savings are not guaranteed by anyone to any value at any time. In years and years, Rory Kinnear was just using this as his savings account. The way that this works, right, the way that this will be a success for you is if you have in detailed insider knowledge as to the exact moment at which the American housing market will crash. If you have that, then you can make a lot of money with this. However, that would be illegal. So you have no way of knowing that. What you are essentially entering is a kind of lottery of when will the American housing market crash?
So, well, interestingly, you might say that, Alice, because it says actually it's built for humans, but backed by real assets. So it's not built for like cats or chinchillas or anything. It's for humans.
Uh-huh. So on the one hand, you're telling me this is like investing all of my savings in lottery tickets. But on the other, you're telling me that it's built for me as a human. And as a human, I love when things are built for me as a human.
I also did go to their FAQs page, and you've sort of you have sort of
I got some
this.
Fucking cues. I want to A these Fs.
I'm very frequent. I mean, so the first frequently asked question is Telus FDIC insured? No, no, it is not.
we're here for your money, not the bank's money. Your money is not insured by the federal government.
You are gonna lose a dime.
Yeah, you are gonna lose a lot of dimes, many dimes.
So they say, with Telus, your money is always at hand's reach. Every dollar you deposit is backed by real assets, not stocks or crypto, but American housing loans. Cool.
Famously secure. If you have the memory of a goldfish, yeah. If you don't recall anything bad that has ever happened to financial instruments based on American homes.
No one's defaulting on those as interest rates go up.
No.
I have to tell you all, this gets so much better. It says, okay. Here's another great sentence you want to read on your savings account's webpage. To date, Telus has met every payment obligation, and our expert customer service team is here to assist you when you need to speak with a person.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the housing market's fine-ish now. So, yeah, why wouldn't it? Yeah. It's like every, as I sort of sail into the Category 5 hurricane, every wave that has hit this boat has, like, gone under the hull. It's fine.
And if you need to make a panicked call to someone, there is someone who will take that call. So, cool.
Yeah, an anime girl that wants you to also admit your crimes.
That's right. So, this is from TechCrunch.
CFW, no FBI, GF.
This is from TechCrunch.
Oh, we love
an article about idea. It's a great source for startups. It really is.
You could
represent a lot of what is written in TechCrunch articles in like a with a little more sarcastic language, and it would make about as much sense. This is from TechCrunch. With mortgage interest rates having more than doubled since 1 year ago, one might think this is not the best time to be a digital mortgage lender doubling as a savings account.
One might.
Yeah, because like I said, if you remember, it doesn't make the return through like landlording. It's not a real estate investment trust. It makes the returns through loans to homeowners. But co-founder Rocky Lee believes his company's unique business model sets it apart from other lenders. For one, the company has exclusively a very niche real estate offering, which is always a good sign.
It's a very unique business model in the same way that walking around holding a landmine is a unique business model. It's like, yeah, but it's kind of unique for a reason in that it's potentially quite self-destructive.
So here's the business model. This is Rocky Lee. The home that Telus borrowers buy is typically not a starter home. What they are seeking is something called a super jumbo, which is designed for people don't have a ready-to-use mortgage solution for the problem that they face.
And here I thought a super jumbo was... I thought a super jumbo was like on the secret 7-Eleven menu.
It's that? Yeah, it's a mortgage. You go to a 7-Eleven, you order a super jumbo, then they give you hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then someone else makes 5% interest, presumably forever.
So, yeah, I'd like for animal stuff.
So what you're saying is people who find it difficult to get a conventional trad-stayed conservative mortgage.
Correct. It's it targets...
Because they're likely to default on it in the estimation of those mortgage lenders.
It says, it targets existing homeowners who wish to upgrade to larger homes without selling the homes they live in now. which makes it difficult for them to get approved for loans by traditional mortgage lenders. And they say,
yeah, because so wait. This isn't just homes that are going to get foreclosed on. This is second homes that are going to get foreclosed on, and it's entirely based on like jet ski dealership MAGA chuds who decide that now, as the economy gets worse, is the time to like really stick it to Joe Brandon and buy that real estate in Florida.
Well, so the way I see it, just from reading the copy here, it's number one. It's usually about 2% higher than a standard mortgage, so they're charging a premium. And then they say, but it's fine because usually, once you own the second home, you can then mortgage that to close out your super jumbo. And again, this seems to be one of those things that only works so long as everything can keep moving. And we all know
everything
keeps moving always.
It's very funny that what we've done in the course of doing these is to replicate the American housing market to like down to an individual level, where you're just sort of meant to like collateralize and trade off of your own debt obligations.
Yeah, but what else are you going to do with them?
Pay them back?
So maybe? TechCrunch said to Rocky Lee, this sounds risky.
Yeah, no shit.
Lee then said to TechCrunch that TELUS uses, quote, very strict underwriting criteria and has not yet seen any of its defaults because the majority of its borrowers go on soon to refinance their loans at more favorable terms. Anyway, I've watched the first 30 or so minutes of The Big Short, and from what I remember, is that everyone in Florida got to refinance their loans at more favorable terms, which was fine.
Yeah, I assume that's what Margot Robbie said in that bit. I assume that's the case. Yeah.
Also, no surprise that Andreessen Horowitz is behind this. You know, part of his effort show that he cares about people getting new homes, you know, once he was found out to be like a NIMBY who was trying to stop development anywhere near his own home.
Yeah, Paris.
And crucially, only second homes. It's like, it's so sort of like cartoonishly evil on its face.
He just wants people to have super jumbo homes like he has out in Atherton, California.
What's the street address of that?
Well, I'm not providing assassination coordinates here, sorry.
Sorry, it's not actually second homes. It's rather if you want to upgrade your house, but then
keep your other house
and then like rent it out. So effectively, it's a landlording solution, but like one step removed, effectively. So you're giving the buy-to-let mortgage. You're facilitating someone getting a buy-to-let mortgage with what is essentially a bridging loan.
See, this is the reason why I love America, right? In the United Kingdom, when we wanted to subsidize landlords, we had to have the government do it and destroy all of our social housing stock. In the US, only the US could have come up with a way of doing that that also dynamites their entire housing economy.
Anyway.
It's beautiful. It's incredible. This is the best startup you've given us in a while.
I know. I liked it. Just the fact that they were like, oh, that sounds risky. And he was like, hasn't gone wrong yet. And they can always refinance. I'm sure they can always refinance and they always will be able to. I love that my savings account happens to be connected to the phrase, they can always refinance. That's awesome. That's so
also
cool.
What does the name TELUS have to do with this whole business model? How does it relate?
It's just a sort of like reassuring noise at this point, I feel.
Tell us
how you
want to
blow up the housing market.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell your FBI girlfriend.
Yeah, tell the FBI girlfriend what you're going to do to the housing market. anyway, so that's TELUS. But I want to move on to our
Can we talk about AI now? The technology that the FBI badly needs in order to develop girlfriend simulator.
Yeah, so this is something that I think is... this is something that we're going to go back to probably quite a bit in the next year or so, depending on how long. I mean, let's say depending on
how
long
it lasts. This is where all the like charlatans are. This is where, or like, apart from a handful of like holdouts, people have moved from crypto into this.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I feel like every year there's a whole new thing that like I have to learn about that just sucks and that I know is going to be like irrelevant within 12 months. But you know,
yeah. Well,
it's great for a podcast, though.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, great for content.
I feel bad for our country, but this is tremendous content.
So look, the amount of hype around the AI large language models, around the use of like AI, of generative AI and so on and so on, it's very considerable. I mean, we're seeing an almost identical thing happen where BuzzFeed announced that it was redoing some of its, like, what used to go to unpaid contributors. They were using AI to generate that.
And do you ever remember the Tumblr account BuzzFeed without images, where it was just like the listicles, but it was just the text in them, and most of them were like this. That's what BuzzFeed is automating. This is a very low bar.
Very difficult.
My favorite one was just like a one that went Yaz goals and then nothing.
But yeah, it was to become part of the band Yaz. For me that reminded me of when Long Island Iced Tea said they were pivoting to blockchain, and again got their stock went up by about 200%, which also BuzzFeed's did approximately as well. So what I'm saying is, right, there is certainly an enormous amount of very similar hype, but because, like I've talked about before, when it comes to AI, because it has the possibility to change the relationship for the worse between labor and capital, unlike crypto, which was just a speculative asset and did not carry that possibility, I think you might see it stick around for longer, even if it's also where all those charlatans have also gone. So unfortunately, yeah, I don't think we'll have seen the back of it in 12 months.
No, I mean, it's difficult to speculate as to how much there is with AI. I think some of it is potentially very silly, whether it remains so, beyond its ability to just sort of automate and displace labor. I don't know. It's entirely possible it will stay this dumb, but it will still also put you out of a job. But the other thing is that, the people who should take an interest in this are, and people who would, seem to have an interest in, betting on this are betting heavily on this. Whether they're right or not, we don't know. But even up to it's the same as ARPA with the internet back in the day, right? It may not have worked, but the fact that it did, the results that it got, AI, I suspect, is much the same. It's like, if this works, it is worth any amount of bullshit that we put into it. And that's the calculation that's being made.
Yeah, it's a fair point. And I think it's difficult at the moment to totally figure out where it's going, because we're in the midst of this massive hype cycle, right? And so you need to try to determine what the technology is actually doing, to what degree it's actually novel and in advance on what came before, or to what degree that is something that's based around the hype that we are just really kind of buying into, because a lot of people want to believe that this is making some degree of progress on what happened before. Obviously I think we saw a lot of this, even 5 to 7 years ago. There was a lot of, news articles and a lot of stories around how AI and automation were going to wipe out a ton of jobs and it's going to completely upend everything. And that didn't really work out how it was being promised in that moment. And that's why I'm still a bit skeptical as we see all of these headlines about ChatGPT and Stable Diffusion and stuff like that now. I think that there's a potential that it could be more impactful than it was, almost a decade ago, but I'm not totally convinced yet. And some of the people I talk to are these things really aren't performing the way that it's often presented in the media and by these people who are pushing it and by the boosters who really want us to buy into these things.
The important thing is that we're rushing headlong towards this as quickly and with the least amount of thinking about it as possible, right? And I think there is potentially a moral hazard here. I'm not saying necessarily that we're going to make Skynet or we're going to make the fucking machines from the Matrix doing this, right? But given that the booster faction of this is every VC and hedge fund and big tech company, and the we should be careful how we think about and use this faction is academics and podcasts, right?
Some podcasts, not all of them.
yeah. If this goes the way of AI deciding to make everything into paperclips, we're getting fucking paperclips. We are getting so paperclips. Yeah,
what the fuck are you going to do? Podcast about it? Fuck off. Your microphone's paperclips, bitch.
Yeah, seeing the microphone arm just creep upwards into paperclips and be like, oh no. Okay.
We'll just flood the podcast AI generated tech booster podcasts saying how great AI is.
I mean, it'll be easy to do. I mean, there are thousands of hours of our voices on the internet. That's a training set.
It's easy to just replicate Lex Friedman podcast because he's so stupid.
I was gonna say, there's a tech optimist guy that I follow on my work Instagram account, not my personal one. My personal one is filled with lovely pictures of my wife. But my work one. And he actually wrote one of his video scripts, because he does like YouTube videos entirely by like ChatGPT, and like kind of put out this thing where it's like, oh yeah, no one knew like how that I use an auto, like I used a bot for this whole thing. And my only kind of reaction was like, well, yeah, but it's because you sound like an AI bot. Like, so it wasn't difficult to imitate something that you were already doing.
The first human to fail a Turing test.
But I was going to say, like, because this was like sort of based on like the BuzzFeed stuff that came out fairly recently, but also just like something that like we've spoken about a bit on this show. I think when James came on, we spoke about it. And I, like me and Phoebe have talked about it on like on 10K Post, which is that like the use case of a like the ChatGPT is not necessarily that it is better than humans at doing kind of certain even like creative processes, but it suffices. It creates like low level stuff, which like a lot of the internet is kind of already filled with, right? Like low level ad copy, low level sort of SEO max copy. And so like where BuzzFeed, and I have like some insider baseball of this, having worked there for a little bit and knowing people who have worked there and everything. You know, the way that it's sort of gone in the past few years, where it's sort of decimated a lot of its news operations, it's like when it was doing like essays and literary, tried to do literary content and stuff. And Jonah Peretti was kind of just at some point, I think in 2021, he was just like, yeah, we're going back to like doing ads, and we're going to focus mostly on like shopping and selling products and all that type of stuff. And that's kind of where its revenue was coming from. It was like lucrative deals with like tech companies, with Amazon and so on. And if you look at that copy, like a lot of that can be very easily like done by a chatbot, right? You don't need a human to sort of sell you like cheap Amazon products or like cheap Wayfair products or whatever like kind of partnership they've got with. And so these types of interactions online, or this type of content online, where it doesn't really matter whether a human is sort of giving you that or like providing you that, because you're not really that I imagine most people are not really that focused or care that much about whether they're interacting with a human or not. I feel like that's where the AI stuff does really well. And the sad thing about that, I don't know whether this will be like a temporary change or a permanent one, but I suppose that as the kind of internet fills with this like cheap low level content that does very well on social media platforms, including and especially ones that are so broken that like you're getting them regardless of whether you want them or not, like that's where the value of AI comes in. It's not, we're going to solve this problem and make your experience better. It's, yeah, we're going to be able to produce this type of SEO maxing stuff at a much faster rate.
So look, all of these things are germane to the hype cycle and how you see it. But underneath the hood, if you like, in the large companies that are actually investing in these things and bringing them to market. And by the way, when we talk about the AI arms race, the AI arms race is used by a lot of analysts, especially like analysts at that you'll sort of read who cover these companies. But you cannot forget that at the same time, there has been another AI arms race going on for a long time between the US and China. But fundamentally...
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, we have to develop the FBI girlfriend, because if we don't, China will develop the Ministry of Public Security girlfriend.
But fundamentally, right, the competitive dynamic is the same, and that's the thing that I want.
Why does this chatbot keep asking me if I'm Muslim?
That fundamentally,
either one.
The competitive it seems to be and give me a lot of places to buy pressure cookers. Weird. The Alexa that induces you to buy a pressure cooker. But
yeah, it's the one that asks you if you're buying a pressure cooker versus the one that asks you what your favorite like Uyghur food is.
The competitive dynamic fundamentally at play here, whether it's between Microsoft and Google or whether it's between the US and China, right? It's the same dynamic, which is this is a winner take all situation and what we have to do is we have to send the AI. And again, this is assuming it does what they say it can do, which a lot of serious people seem to be putting serious money behind it.
You can't take the chance, right? Like if you scoff at AI, pretty soon AI generated Chinese Marines are going to be storming the beaches of Hawaii, and you know, and it's going to be your fault.
But
so
in the metaverse,
right? But the incentive
with no legs, you know, just torso, head, rifle, arms.
The incentive, right? The incentive is fundamentally for these businesses is to go as far as possible, to push the AI to do as much as possible, to interfere in more tasks, to go broader and deeper. Yep. The same thing with the states. The incentives are the same. And they understand as well that there is danger in doing this. They understand that there is that they expose.
Yeah, what about that thread with the like creepy AI face generated woman? Yeah. What about that woman?
Well, but
what about that? You know, what if China had one of her?
Right, effectively, right. The this is in fact this is a quote from Eric Schmidt, the guy from the Google founder, who is now on the he's the chairman of the Special Competitive Studies Project, which is basically a AI arms race think tank based in the U.S. So connected to Washington.
All these motherfuckers think they're doing the Manhattan Project. I swear to fucking God.
It says,
and like,
I'm pretty sure
he had an AI book like ghostwritten with Henry Kissinger, I think, like last year or the year before.
Oh, we should read that. Eric Schmidt said, as long as an AI system has an objective set by a human, most ethics concerns or safety concerns related to AI come from the ethics of the countries wielding them. The country you can make decisions the fastest will have an advantage, but leaving humans in the loop slows things down. The real issue, he says, is the compression of time. These systems are going to have to make decisions faster than human decision-making time, and that's where the boundary is going to be. We have to have a serious conversation about that as a society, in my opinion. And the incentive, whether you're a state or a company, is to have that boundary as far away as possible, is to have that boundary to push it as far as possible. Not too far, but it has to be one step than the other person, and you don't know how far they're going to push it. That's basically the game theory way of thinking about what's going on here.
This is insanely dangerous. Like, I fully cannot stress how dangerous this is, especially once they start putting this, well, I mean, they've already started, especially once they start fielding this in military applications, because there are a lot of times where you want that kind of fast decision making, where you want a computer to be able to recognize, oh, hey, you know, which of these swarm of missiles heading towards this carrier group in the Pacific are like real and which ones aren't, things of this nature, right? Once you start doing that and you take a human out of the loop and you go, well, we have to deploy this as quickly as possible and we have to not think about it because it leaves us at a competitive advantage, that vastly increases the chances of an unintentional shooting war between two nuclear powers, the United States and China. This is one of those cases where arms race becomes very quickly going from metaphorical to literal. And you want to fucking be careful about it because I don't want to get vaporized along with everyone else because of Mark Andreessen's pointy fucking head.
So, Paris, I'm interested to sort of get your reflection here.
Yeah, the idea that AI development like should be is okay because it'll be guided by like the ethics of the United States as a country is like very disturbing, which is something that Schmidt is kind of asserting there. And just on your point, Alice, I'm pretty sure there was a story like last year where the Israelis were using a gun like in Iran that was, you know, basically controlled by AI, not by like a human remotely to like attack some like official or blow
up
their
vehicle.
I'm
not sure. I know what you're talking about, but I'm not sure if that was remote controlled or if that was like AI controlled. And I'm not sure if we will know that.
Yeah.
But,
I can't remember for sure. I feel like
it's definitely something that's being investigated in terms of stuff like how you like, for instance, patrol a denied area. You can have like AI controlled minefields, I've heard being talked about. I mentioned that in a previous episode and Milo made fun of me, but he's not here and I'm still right, by the way. Or like you put a fucking you put a gun on a Roomba and you drive it around and the Roomba is set to like AI detect, is there a person in this image like multiple times a second? And if there is, it fucking shoots them. That's like an area that would save a lot of time and money. And, you know, that's probably going to be the first thing that breaches the rule of like, so far we haven't had, to my knowledge, an AI kill someone on purpose yet. And I think when that happens, it's not even an if, when that happens, it will probably be a situation like that.
Yeah. And if they did, they probably wouldn't tell us anyway. But I think on the broader point that you're getting at, Riley, like, you know, there are so many levels.
It was AI assisted. Fuck, you're right.
Yeah, the Israeli-Iran. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
No, I thought so. So yeah, there we go. It's already happened. But yeah,
because they killed Mohsen Fakhrizadeh with it. Yeah,
that was a nuclear scientist or something, right?
Yes, he was. He was the head of the Iranian nuclear program, and they killed him from like a mile away with a light machine gun that they had modified to be AI assisted in a way that they don't explain, but also remotely controlled.
Yeah. So
it's already going on. So to the broader point, like, I think it's really risky seeing the way that this is moving. And, you know, it's similar to any other kind of tech hype cycle, in the sense that the venture capitalists and the funders get really excited about a particular technology. And then to a certain degree, they're not interested as much in like other technologies and funding those, because they might not have the same potential, you know, revenues as, you know, whatever is getting all the hype at this moment. You know, part of the reason why we saw BuzzFeed announce, you know, it's going to use AIs, and then it's stock like soared, because that is something that investors are looking for. It's what they're expecting they're going to be able to make money off in the near future. And so now you have all of this excitement around AI. And so you have, you know, obviously OpenAI is the one behind ChatGPT, and Microsoft has invested $10 billion to start integrating that with Bing and its other kind of services. And that has pushed Google, you know, the reports say, to kind of take any kind of, or take much of its kind of ethical considerations. You know, how much of those were actually there in the first place? I think Timnit Gebru would say not very many, because they fired her over calling attention to some of those things. So they are kind of taking those safeguards off and saying, okay, we need to get this out into the public as quickly as possible. And then you have all these other companies as well that are lining up and saying, okay, we need to launch our, you know, AI chatbot and our AI image service, and we need to develop our own of these to try to compete in this field, because this is the next big thing that's really taking off this year. But then, of course, you know,
meanwhile, poor Mark Zuckerberg is just sitting there in the metaverse, like... I thought it was going to be me, you know.
Can we create AI-generated metaverse objects? Is that going to help us?
Well, at least the legs.
There is one thing, though, which amused me, which is that reflecting that the first two professions to get put out of work by AI were BuzzFeed caption writers and Mossad assassins. Strange bedfellows, you know?
Yeah, quite.
And specifically, that is one of the things I'd also want to identify as well, right? Which, as you say, Paris, it's correct that this the companies in now viewing themselves in an arms race with one another while these other arms races are going on, are sidelining the already most sidelined people in the world. Just yeah. Sidelined much further.
I just wanted to say that this is where Facebook got it wrong. They didn't realize, they thought it was going to be a leg race. They didn't realize what game they were playing.
It was a mind race this whole time.
Yeah, what you're talking about there as well, Riley, is like the larger kind of geopolitical technological fight that is like being lined up here, right? Especially as the United States really starts to, or is trying to draw like a hard line between the West and China. And that is of course very beneficial to a lot of these tech companies, as I'm sure that you've talked about on the show, where, you know, they are using this larger kind of geopolitical rivalry to benefit themselves, and saying, you know, we shouldn't be, you know, you shouldn't be doing antitrust scrutiny against us and all these sorts of things, because if you do that, we won't be able to effectively compete against China. And so there's always, China.
Interestingly, so if you remember this, this is what Mark Zuckerberg, the one guy who's not the beneficiary of this, said to Greg Stubbe a couple of years ago. This is exactly his point.
A wartime Facebook. And I mean, as we know that sort of Joe Biden is sort of very, very alive to sort of technological competition against China. We've seen him sort of like decimate the Chinese semiconductor industry overnight. And clearly, I think the hope is that you just do sort of do more of that, you know, do more sort of like precautionary measures that benefit American companies in this respect in order to disadvantage Chinese ones.
Totally. And
that seems pretty clear.
Yeah, I think the other thing there too is like when you're looking at what's going on in this rivalry, we're looking at kind of the tech developments that are playing out, and especially when we look at kind of the AI race. It looks to me like China is actually doing more to potentially regulate what might be coming of these technologies. You know, they went on a big regulation spree over the past couple of years with regard to a lot of the technologies that are, you know, being released over there. They put a lot of restrictions on consumer-oriented technologies and algorithms and things like that. So I'm not sure, like, if we're thinking of like the ethics of each side of this kind of equation, it's not to say that there's no problem with China or the CCP or like tech development that goes on in China. That's not at all what I'm saying. But I think that when we're kind of positioning it this way, it's often that, or at least when the media positions it this way, it's often that, like, you know, China doesn't care. China will do anything. So we need to be able to compete with that. And that means we need to be able to take the guardrails off, if we even had guardrails in the first place, because our motto has always been move fast and break things. And so it's like a further justification for them to do whatever they want and to not be held accountable for what they're doing. Whereas like, I think the boogeyman that they're setting up is not nearly as scary or as terrible as they're always making us try to believe.
Especially because even if all of what they say is true, they don't have a lot of chips at this point.
Sure, they still have chips, just not the most advanced ones, right?
Yeah, but that's one of the things that the semiconductor, you know, sanctions and stuff have been very effective at, is you're not going to create the Ministry for Public Security girlfriend, because you don't have the facilities for that anymore.
Until they invade Taiwan and just take over the what's the name of that company?
that's going to be an interesting thing, but I put that off until the 2030s. But
TSMC is the single most rigged to explode building in the world.
Really? Yes. Okay. Yeah. I think that it's sort of germane to talking about the ideology of the Chinese Communist Party, that like part of their deal is they love being the party, the state that regulates things. And, you know, regulates things in order to govern them in a way that is sort of like, an acceptable middle way, all of this. Whether they have the, like, ability to make that regulation stick, it's not always been the case. How they deploy it externally, also occasionally very different. So I'm kind of like, I'm not sure it's possible to know, and I'm not sure how useful it is to speculate. What I think we can say is that, you know, American companies, American developers of this are being catastrophically irresponsible, and great, you know, what else is new?
Yeah. So there's something I wanted to go into a little bit more as well, right? Which is that while we're talking about this, right, that there's an attention that you can't ignore as well, which is that the human element of knowledge work, because if let's talk about this in terms of a category, right, it's never fully gone. It's never powerful enough that you're able to fully remove the human element. I mean, every week it seems like we get more stories of sort of Kenyan workers being hired to like make sure that ChatGPT doesn't say anything too horrible, right?
It's like, the real superpower in this US-China race is Kenya.
Yeah,
but basically, like a large portion of this is like, how quickly and like effectively can you offshore this to people to do all of the like menial work to make all of this grand imagination actually work? And it's not a low stakes game.
So it's the thing where you have to hold in your head at the same time that a lot of it is very sort of janky and shoddy and shitty, and at the same time extremely dangerous, precisely because of the incentives involved among the people deploying the technology, because of the incentive to go as far as possible with as much as possible. And so I think you mentioned earlier the idea of search. That's a great one, right? And how I think it also comes to one of my general theories of these things, which is that the technological revolution actually just ratifies a lot of what was in place before. No one's ever thought of anything like that, by the way. That's kind of thesis antithesis transformation thing. No one's ever done that. But what a lot of what we talk about search, right? This is very interesting. A lot of search has been made less useful by people acting more like AIs anyway, right? Of using a lot of terms that are not necessary, that they don't understand, but thinking like an algorithm and making like Google worse, for example. And so you can think of that as putting a technology, not in the terms of like a technology like of circuit boards and cogs and all these things, but a technology in terms of a technique, a way of doing things that's abstracting you from the information that you're seeking, right? There is you have to interpret someone else's interpretation of something that is trying to manipulate the results of what you're seeing. And doing that with something like AI, which is very good at being confidently wrong, as we've talked about before, it's very good at doing fluent bullshit. When it passes an MBA exam, it's because it's trained on the answer bank. And if you ask the question a little differently, it will give you the wrong answer, right? All of these things being true. But that the incentive among companies and governments to go as far and as fast as possible means that those levels of abstraction are going to go into more things in your life outside your job, maybe. Maybe they're going to go into how you learn about the world. And or how maybe it's going to go into how you get around. Maybe it's going to go into how your food is how you order your food, maybe at a kiosk, or maybe it's going to go somewhere in the food chain that you don't know it's there. And you're going to have to rely on levels of abstraction that are good at being superficially right. And because of the competitive dynamics between the players in this situation, because they don't know how far one another will go and they have to be furthest, there is a huge danger that more of your life is going to be abstracted very, very poorly and using a lot of the digital sort of sweatshop labor of, say, Kenyans. There it is. That is the AI arms race in a nutshell, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I think you've put it well. And I think it relates back to what Hussein was saying earlier, right? Where so much of the web is being like churned out with this kind of AI generation or around SEO kind of language in order to game the search engines, and the search engines get useless. Like, I feel like I see a lot of reactions from people now just saying like, the web feels like shit. Like, it feels like we're in the late stage of like whatever this internet has been for a long time, where like, it's just like, there's so much junk, like there's so much garbage that has just kind of like accumulated. And these chat tools, ChatGPT, whatever, feels like it's just trying to add like a massive new wave of this to it. I saw a tweet, like a proposal for a company or a service or something recently. And it was like, what if you made a little prompt for ChatGPT or whatever, and then it generated an email based on that, that was sent to whoever you're going to send it to. And then they used a little chat tool to turn that email into like a much more like a summarized version of what was in the email. And it's like, so we're like throwing these tools.
That's your prompt.
Yeah, totally. So we're throwing these tools like in the middle of our communication, and like everything just gets like abstracted and turned into something that, like, you know, we're not even communicating with one another. We're communicating through these AI tools. And like, I just don't see how this is attractive. Like, it just drives me crazy.
Paris, do you know what you're describing? You're describing the technical architecture of email with another additional step. Because what you're talking about is you're talking about the encoding of something. You're talking about encoding and decoding. It's just one additional step of encoding and decoding on either side, where the only formal language that ever gets sent is only read and written by machines.
Totally. But like, I think the real difference is that when I write up an email and it gets sent to someone, at least it's like what I said, what I wrote. This is like everything is being filtered through an AI that's rewriting what you want to say and then reinterpreting it for the receiver. And it's like, what does that do to how we communicate with one another, how we understand one another? I just think it's a mess.
I think I just see a lot of parallels between that, because I think I've seen that thread, but I've also seen similar ones again from like these sort of like AI. I don't want to call them optimists, but like the people who are kind of working in an AI or at least sort of want to make like money doing it somehow, who will kind of just say like the most absurd shit about like why this technology like has a use case and why actually it's going to like make things better. Except like, it's not really with the crypto stuff. It just sounded insane, partly because again, it was like we were dealing with like a kind of speculative asset. So like kind of the bullshit speculation was sort of built on top of that. I think with this, I don't know whether like like coming at it with like a critical, if not cynical approach is more natural, because there is just no evidence that this is going to make your time as a user, or even just as someone who like works on the internet, to be any better. I guess like that sort of like links back to how bad Google search is, and so much so that like I now use like Reddit to search most things, right? And it seems like a much more like helpful and easier approach to do that. But like, you know, the reason why that has happened is not necessarily, it's not like a technical glitch, it's because that's how Google is designed. And like, you know, that's how this system is built. And so in the kind of like AI optimistic, like if you sort of interrogate it long enough, what you kind of see is that they've kind of accepted that the internet isn't really going to get better, or like, you know, for users, it's not going to be like an enjoyable place. What they're actually talking about is like, here is like the ways in which, as you mentioned, right, they like how you can abstract it further and like make more kind of short-term money out of that. So if that means like reinventing yourself as like a prompt engineer and using that as like a side hustle, then that is kind of considered to be a good. And if you can use AI to kind of be more kind of quote unquote productive at your email job, and that counts as like something that is kind of a net good. So even within, even like I ultimately, whenever I sort of see this, I kind of, you know, it's very telling that even among this sort of optimists in this kind of so-called arms race, you can kind of tell that even they're not sort of buying their own bullshit in terms of the sort of like grander visions of how this is how tech is making your life better. Really, it comes down to like, yeah, you can sort of like make money doing this in a very kind of confusing way.
So look, I think this comes back to, I think, our broadly something that we talk about with our thesis on AI quite a bit, which is it doesn't matter if it's good or bad, it is coming. And I think understanding the dynamics in the big players of the quote unquote arms race, especially Google, the laggard, who was most frightened and running to catch up with Microsoft, gives you a little bit of a sense of where it's going. But Paris, I'd like to give you the last word before we wrap up.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting narrative to like see Google as the laggard. Like that's how it's being presented in the media, when OpenAI's entire like suite of tools is built on like a Google kind of thing that it did like a few years ago. And it's like
the Transformer.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was called. I assume that's it. Okay. Sorry. I think it's fascinating to see where this is going to go, and especially how far these companies are going to try to push it, how they are going to try to frame it in their kind of narrativizing of, you know, what they are trying to achieve. Because as we know, you know, they have really well-paid PR people who are used to churning out kind of utopian visions of what technology is going to mean for all of us. But I feel like we're, you know, if we weren't already in it before, we're really in this cycle of like, feels like every year or two, there's a new thing that the tech industry is putting out there that's like absolute shit that they're promising us is amazing, that obviously doesn't deliver on any of that. And like every single time we have to go through this like cycle of, oh my God, the new technology is here. Wow, it's going to do all these great things. And then people are like, is it really though? I don't think so. And then it doesn't happen. And then we just move on to like the next thing, and this just restarts over and over again. I'm just like so tired of it.
Yeah. Last frontier of capital, baby. It's credibility.
Well, listen, the good thing is it'll only last until we all get turned into paperclips.
Yeah,
paperclips or dust. It depends if Microsoft or a state sort of automates a little too much, a little too quickly, whether or not it's paperclips or dust. So place your bets. Yeah,
I guess now we hope that the long-termists will, you know, just upload us all into their servers and stick them on planets out into the universe as they're planning, so we can live forever. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, that'll be fine then. I guess we have nothing to worry about. Disregard
then
the previous
episode.
Then we
truly become the computers in the AI.
Yeah, finally. But I want to thank Paris for coming and hanging out with us today, and to recommend that you go listen to Tech Won't Save Us for lots of wonderful interviews with various associated people, including Hussein, who's been on. Hussein's been on Tech Won't Save Us.
I have. A few times.
Also, I want to say, if you are a TF fan and you are in Berlin, Germany, or in easy reach of Berlin, Germany,
to Berlin, Germany.
I was about to say, on September 11th, 2001.
Where was that?
Commemorate 9/11 in Berlin, Germany.
We're commemorating 9/11 on March 11th, so 3/11, with the music of 3/11. So we're going to be in Berlin on the September 11th of March, March 11th.
This is not at all confusing.
Yeah, it's four days.
Come to Berlin
before the
Ides
of March.
On March the 11th. We will be doing a show.
Yeah.
Some of us will speak some German to you, but mostly it will be in English.
Yeah.
February 20th, we will be doing a live show in London. Tickets are available for that at time of recording, although they are selling out quickly. So act now.
Yeah.
If you are in London at the end of February, if you are in Berlin in the second week of March.
Yes. That's right.
Yeah, February 20th is the 9/11 of February. So
yeah, that's right. It's when we will be on February 20th, we will be reading the Liz Truss book with comedian Nish Kumar live for your entertainment.
Say what you will. Muhammad Asa would have loved it.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. September 11th to yours.
All right. Well, see you next time on listening to the show. Make sure your AirPods don't get turned into paper clips. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.